Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, I'm Mike Pesca, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. Today is the last day of September, which makes this coming Monday the first day of October. So we give you the free calendar math. But it's significant because it's the start of the new Supreme Court term. It looks like they'll be weighing in on health care reform, and if so, that could influence the 2012 election. To preview some of the cases expected to come up this term, I'm joined by Amy Howe, editor of SCOTUS blog, as in Supreme Court of the United States, web blog, I guess. That's what the block stands for, did at one point. She's a partner at Goldstein & Russell, a law firm specializing in Supreme Court litigation. Welcome back to WNYC, Amy.
It's great to be back. Thanks for inviting me.
What are you most excited about?
We are most excited, I think, like virtually everyone else who follows the Supreme Court, about health care. There are certainly some fascinating cases that are currently on the court's docket, cases that we know for sure that the court will review between now and the end of June. But there's been a lot of anticipation really for over a year now about the prospect that the Supreme Court would consider the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act this term. And on Wednesday, it seemed very, very likely, almost certain, that the court will, because the government filed its brief seeking review of a lower court's decision striking down the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act as unconstitutional. So by doing that on Wednesday, it set up the possibility and indeed the likelihood that by the end of June, we would get a decision out of the Supreme Court right smack in the middle of the presidential election about whether or not the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional.
Right. And before we go any further, and we will, you want to disclose what your firm does with this case?
Yes. My firm represents the AARP on health care. So glad to talk about sort of the procedure and what the government may be thinking. I will not personally be weighing in on the constitutionality of the act.
That's okay. We have Clarence Thomas online, too. He's the last guy I would ever talk about it, even in the court. Do lower courts disagree on aspects of the Obamacare plan?
They do. So the government is seeking review of a decision out of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, which deals with a couple of states in the South, including Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. And so in that case, Florida and a group of other states had filed a challenge to the Affordable Care Act, and a three-judge panel in that court struck down the mandate as unconstitutional. There are two other decisions out of courts of appeals currently on the Affordable Care Act. One of them is out of the Sixth Circuit, and there is a petition for certiorari seeking Supreme Court review of this decision that's already at the court as well. And in that case, the court, including a judge named Jeffrey Sutton, who was appointed by President George W. Bush and who clerked for Antonin Scalia and at least until this year was a conservative hero, that court held that the Affordable Care Act was not sort of what we call on its face. There were not, that at least in some circumstances, it could be constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it held
did
was
he
that,
use the Latin phrase ipso facto? I'm going to guess he said
so
ipso facto.
They were,
yeah.
The challengers in that case were bringing what lawyers call a facial challenge.
Gotcha.
They were arguing that it was always unconstitutional and that the Sixth Circuit said no. You know, you can come back in 2014, perhaps when the law goes into effect, and argue that it's unconstitutional in your particular case, but we're not going to strike down the whole law as unconstitutional at this point.
Right. The mandate to buy insurance, it's novel. That doesn't mean it's unconstitutional. What part of the Constitution is being pointed to for those who are arguing it is unconstitutional?
Well, I think they're arguing, and this actually sort of leads into the third decision by another court of appeals, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. And in that case, the government actually drew a panel that was made up of three judges appointed by Democratic presidents. And they rejected the challenge, although not on the ground that the government had hoped. The government had argued, you know, it's constitutional. And they said, we're not going to reach the constitutionality right now because this penalty that you have to pay if you don't buy insurance under the individual mandate is, in effect, a tax. And there's this law called the Anti-Injunction Act that does not allow you to bring a challenge to a tax until it's applied to you. So it, too, although on different grounds than the Sixth Circuit, was saying come back in 2014 when you haven't bought your insurance and you've been assessed this tax, and we'll talk.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so given the restrictions because you handle the case, one thing that strikes me about that was I remember when the law passed, there was a lot of analysis. Perhaps you were even called by a member of the media, and there was a general dismissal of the many challenges that the state's attorneys general brought. I just got the impression that even though there was a lot of throat clearing and saber rattling about the constitutionality, this wasn't going to get far in the courts. And it has. Has that surprised the legal community?
I think it has, for the most part. I mean, you're correct that a lot of people, including, for example, a Harvard law professor named Charles Freed, who served as the Solicitor General, which is the government's top lawyer before the Supreme Court, during the Reagan administration, you know, said, well, clearly it's constitutional. And so there was, you know, there was a good bit of surprise, I think, in the legal community that these challenges really got to have some traction. And, you know, indeed, one of the judges on the 11th Circuit panel that struck down the mandate as unconstitutional was a Democratic appointee. So clearly it's, you know, it's probably mostly a liberal conservative issue, but, you know, it can go both ways. It's crossing party lines.
Do you have every confidence that once the Supreme Court rules on the health care challenges, we will have the final word on if health care is constitutional? You know, of course, with Roe versus Wade, it's always being brought up. We could have different Supreme Court justices. They could change their minds. But, you know, given the current composition of the court, will their rulings this term give us pretty firm answers?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, but that assumes that the Supreme Court actually does get to the merits of the case. You know, the government has certainly urged it to do that, and the challenges have urged it to do that. But, you know, on the one hand, there was this ruling by the Fourth Circuit, which covers states like Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina, that never got to the merits, that said, this is a tax, and we can't get into the issue of whether or not it's constitutional right now. Come back in 2014. So it's possible that you could get five justices to sign on and sort of push things off until 2014, which conveniently would be after the presidential election, and it would sort of take the court out of the thick of things. It would, you know, just and sort of leave open the possibility either that, you know, we'd be ruling on it if President Obama were reelected in a, you know, much less contentious environment, or could perhaps keep the court from even having to consider it, because certainly there's a view that if the Republican nominee were to win and the Republicans were to take over Congress, that they would just repeal the Affordable Care Act and the court would never have to get involved. But most people think that if the court decides to take up the issue of the constitutionality, if they accept review in these challenges, they will give a once and for all ruling.
You mentioned a past Solicitor General who's now at Harvard. A current member of the Supreme Court was once at Harvard and then became Solicitor General, Elena Kagan. Because she was part of the Obama administration, is she going to have to? Actually, I think that there's no such thing as have to when it comes to Supreme Court recusals. But is it expected she will recuse herself from this decision?
It is not. I mean, this certainly came up before even her confirmation, and everything that has come out so far indicates that she was never really involved in discussions about the constitutionality of the act in the government's litigation strategy. And sort of a little known fact that's actually significant is that the court has actually had a couple of petitions on health care before it already this past spring. There were a couple of cases in which challenges to the act were seeking super expedited Supreme Court review, and the Supreme Court turned down those challenges, which would not be at all unusual. They like to wait for the lower courts to weigh in fully before they take something up. But when the court disposed of those challenges, those petitions denied certiorari, nobody recused him or herself, which any justice that felt like he or she was going to have to recuse from health care challenges generally would have had to do. So there will probably continue to be a lot of debate about whether various justices should recuse themselves, but I think that these issues are pretty much settled now.
We're speaking with Amy Howe, editor of SCOTUS blog, previewing the Supreme Court's upcoming docket. Let's talk about what I think is one of the most intriguing cases, because you don't really have to know that much about the law, though it helps to weigh in on whether you think it's fair or not. In U.S. versus Jones, a police department used GPS to track someone, and I think this tracking went on for a long, long time, like months. And it comes down to, if I'm getting this right, they didn't need a warrant to put the GPS device on the person's car because they were claiming that all the driving was done on public thoroughfares. I guess the analogy is it's not that much different than if we put a tail on someone, which we wouldn't need a warrant for. Obviously, other people are saying, you know, tracking someone with a GPS bug is a whole lot different from that. What can you tell me about this case?
Exactly. This is a case they were, you know, wanted to get more information about a suspected drug dealer. So they put a GPS tracking device on his car and used it for 28 days. And so they were able to track him as he went to his stash house. And when they combined this with evidence that they got from his phone records, they, you know, then eventually did get a warrant, discovered massive amounts of cash and cocaine, and he got a life sentence. And so the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, which is regarded as a fairly conservative court, throughout his sentence, he said, you know, they said that he had a reasonable expectation in his privacy of his movements over the course of a month, and that said, yes, he was in public, but, you know, this idea that the police can track you without a warrant, and the government's counterargument is, look, as you said, he was just driving around. We could have put a tail on him and done the exact same thing. This is just a more high-tech and more efficient way of doing it. And so it will be a very interesting case to watch. There was a case about 20 years ago that was sort of a low-tech version of this. The police took an electronic beeper and put it in a container and put it in a suspect's car and followed him around for a day. And the court said, that's fine.
I think actually someone gave him the container, so it wasn't even the police sticking it in there, which is maybe a wrinkle. But yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And so there are a couple of interesting sort of tensions here, that this court has leaned towards a very narrow interpretation of the Fourth Amendment. So on the one hand, this could get a little Orwellian, which is the term that a couple of different lower courts have used, this idea that the police can just slap a GPS tracking device on your car without a warrant and without your knowledge from some remote computer figure out everywhere you go for a month or longer. At least in the case involving the beeper, they had to stay within, you know, a couple of hundred yards of the beeper to get the signal. This was 20 years ago. But on the other hand, you know, I think that the justices tend to be very protective of their privacy, but they may well be swayed by the idea that this guy was out in the open the entire time. This is not like using some sort of high-tech device to see into people's houses or to, you know, use infrared devices to find grow lights or something like that to sniff out people who are growing large amounts of marijuana. And so it's hard to say exactly what the court's going to do, but it seems likely that they will overturn the lower court's decision and say that this is okay under the Fourth Amendment.
Right. I think Justice Silverman, who is on a lower court, in the argument was put forth, you're giving information every 10 seconds about this guy's movement for a month. You're using satellites from outer space. I mean, this is unbelievably high tech compared to a phone tap, which you would have to get a warrant. His opinion was, well, an infinite number of legal peaks at a guy is still infinite times zero. It's still fine.
Right, right. Yeah. And it will, I think that you will hear this at oral argument. It will raise a lot of questions about if the lower court decision in this case were affirmed, what would this mean for, you know, satellite tracking, for, you know, extended photo surveillance? What would this mean in the war on terror? And I think the government, may have strong arguments there that will be very persuasive to the justices.
Now, speaking with Amy Howe, editor of SCOTUS blog, Amy, if we were having this discussion a year, it might be possible that you and I could just curse up a blue streak and it would be okay. Well, at least if those pronouncements were fleeting, depending on FCC versus Fox. This is kind of a famous or a collection of famous cases. I think Cher said something at an award show, and on NYPD Blue, they showed naked buttocks.
Yes.
And it goes back to Nicole Richie is now going to be involved in a Supreme Court case because she and Paris Hilton said some bad words. What's the ruling now? Is it, because I sometimes forget, even though I'm supposed to know as a professional, but I always try to keep it clean. Would a broadcaster incur large fines were it to broadcast a fleeting narrative as it stands right now? A fleeting expletive?
The answer to your question is it depends, and that is the problem. Now, so the FCC has a regulation that prohibits TV stations from airing indecent material between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m., and the theory is that children may be watching, and we need to protect the children. And so the FCC's policy is that fleeting expletives, you know, the use of the F word or the S word, could be indecent. It just depends on the context. And this is, as you can imagine, a little bit difficult for broadcasters to predict whether or not something is going to be, indecent or not. And so this case is actually coming back to the court for the second time. And the first time there was a challenge by Fox and the TV stations to the FCC's authority to enact this policy. And the court said, yes, the FCC has the authority to enact this policy, but we're not going to get into whether it's constitutional right now. So it went back to the lower courts. And the lower court said that the policy is unconstitutional because it's too vague. Broadcasters are just going to have to guess about whether or not something is unconstitutional. So, you know, the strong argument that the FCC has here is that this is designed to protect children. This court loves free speech. We've got violent video games. We've got the Westboro Baptist Church protesting at military funerals.
Crush videos.
The crush videos, exactly. Those are all terrific as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. Unlike the Fourth Amendment, they're very protective of the First Amendment. And in particular, you know, this was the state of California's whole argument last term in the violent videos case was, we need to protect children. Have you looked at these videos? These videos have people being, not actual people, but depictions of people being beheaded and set on fire and mutilated.
Yeah.
And the court's response was, if this disturbs you, don't buy them for your children. So I'm not sure that this argument about protecting children is going to get that far, and it seems very likely that the TV stations will win in this case.
There's a very funny wrinkle in the lower court. They broadcast the discussions over C-SPAN radio, and one of the lawyers, and, you know, as part of the discussions, a lot of bad language is used, and one of the lawyers said, are we or C-SPAN radio going to be fined because of this very discussion? And then, from what I heard, the judge harumphed and didn't give a good answer, which is what judges are supposed to do. All right, let's talk about the immigration cases. Some are accepted. Am I right? The big Arizona law that caused all that controversy, SB 1, 1070, is that not yet and possibly won't be reviewed by the court?
Okay, so yes. Yeah. So there are two different kinds of immigration cases that we can talk about. The court has several immigration cases on its docket that are interpreting, sort of complicated federal laws that Congress has passed to deal mostly with what happens if you are an immigrant in this country and then you get in trouble with the law, you're likely to be deported. And so every year the court has a steady docket of these cases interpreting sort of the interstices of these laws. But the big immigration question is the role of the states in regulating illegal immigration. You know, there have been these laws in Arizona, now there's one in Alabama and one in Pennsylvania, trying to sort of cut back on illegal immigrants and what they can do in the states. And so for a long time, the sort of question to the answer to the question was, well, what can the states do about illegal immigration? Everyone thought it was nothing. You know, immigration is the exclusive purview of the federal government, and the states can't really get involved. Any efforts by the states are going to be trumped by federal laws. But the states were getting really fed up with what they saw as the federal government's lack of action to deal with sort of the day-to-day problems of illegal immigration within the states. And so last term we had a case called Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting at the court, and that was a challenge to an Arizona law, not the Arizona law, SB 1070, that everyone has been talking about, but another Arizona law that did things like take away the business licenses of businesses who repeatedly got caught hiring illegal immigrants. And the court in that case, by a vote of 5-3, said, in this particular case, this law is fine. The state of Arizona can have this law. It can coexist with federal immigration laws. And so now the question is SB 1070, which is another one of the controversial Arizona immigration laws that, you know, that its opponents argue that it's going to lead to racial profiling. And so as soon as that law was enacted, the federal government went to court to try to keep it from being enforced. And so the lower courts refused to enforce the law. And so now the state of Arizona has filed a petition seeking review of the lower court's decisions. And the court has not acted on that petition yet. The government has not responded to it. But it seems very likely that too could happen this term, and we'd have a decision by the end of June.
And does it seem likely that they'll affirm the Arizona law, keep it on the books, knowing this court and its composition?
You know, it's not completely clear. It seems like it has a good shot. The decision in this Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting case was based on a small exception in federal law for licensing laws. And so the state said this is just an effort to regulate licenses, and the Supreme Court agreed. So it's not clear whether this is going to transfer into, you know, approving other state laws that are trying to regulate illegal immigration, but the court certainly seems open to that possibility, and Arizona with SB 1070 is trying to sort of fit the case into a similar box. And so this idea that only the federal government can regulate immigration is certainly gone now. Justice Kagan did not participate in the case last term. From every appearance, it does not seem that she'd be recused from a case involving SB 1070. But this is one of those cases in which it's not clear that it mattered, because the vote was 5-3, with Justice Kennedy joining the four sort of so-called conservative justices to uphold the law.
All right. And there are a couple other great cases we didn't even get to.
There's a lot of great cases.
I don't know if they're great cases. For a legal enthusiast, they certainly are. Affirmative action, MBZ versus Clinton, which is about if you could say you were born in Jerusalem on a passport. But I want to thank you, Amy Howe, editor of the SCOTUS blog, for this preview.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And stick around. We'll be talking about the kill and capture of a major al-Qaeda clerical leader. Stick around in about a minute.